I agree that it was Mr. Reagan's buildup, as the defense minister of China suggested, that gave us the second of the two arrows that we needed in our quiver. It was facilitated, of course, by the lucky break we had that three old men died in rapid succession in the Soviet Union, and the turmoil that created, and it was further aided by the economic chaos of the Soviet Union. But when Gorbachev looked at what his options were, it was clear to him he couldn't match us in the defense sector. We had, as a result of the Reagan buildup, achieved naval and Air Force superiority. We had not achieved superiority of conventional forces in Europe. If we proceed with Gorbachev's suggestion and negotiate this reduction on both sides to equal numbers, 10 to 15% below our current numbers in Europe, this will, in fact, give us an edge that we have never had in Europe. That is, we'll have equality instead of inferiority. I do not believe that Gorbachev's political situation would let him accept superiority on our part in Europe. And I think he's already under some attack from his conservatives because we have superiority at sea and of mobile air forces. So just as I would encourage the Baltic nations not to move too quickly towards sovereignty, I would encourage that we first nail down equality in Europe before we see whether or not the political factors would let us gain superiority. If we can, then I'm like Secretary of State Dean Rusk, whom I heard one time in response to an arms controller who suggested, gee, you can't do that, it wouldn't be fair to the Russians, say, I'm all for it if the Russians will agree to it. I'm for us. Yes?
It has been suggested that if we don't make swift cuts in our military, that we can probably assure that Gorbachev will not stay in power. And the longer we contemplate these changes, we perhaps put ourselves in a more difficult situation. Do you agree with that?
I do agree that if we remain unaffected by his changes and did not work with him to achieve reductions that are sensible from our standpoint, that we would hurt him. He's got to be able to make the case to his military and to his party that they're getting something from our side in response to their reductions if he's going to stay in power. And so I think our objective should be to maintain our superiority in the air and at sea and regain equality in Europe. And that's about as much as we can get away with without unhorsing Gorbachev. Yes?
If your prediction is correct, that there's a 40% survival rate, comment on what might come after, and might it not be better from our the American Western side?
Well, the problem with concluding that it might be better is that there are so many, in my judgment, of these possible scenarios that could transpire. If there was a Tiananmen Square type incident in the Soviet Union where the military just went in and smashed the independence movements in every nation and restored strict party control. And if, as a result of that, the Soviets were able to become more aggressive and to use their holdings in Eastern Europe and elsewhere to just kind of force-feed their own economy with regard to at least food and consumables, then we would be worse off. If the Soviet Union began to unravel and could do so without the West being forced to put in massive support of one kind or another to feed starving populations, then we'd be better off. But there are so many possibilities for it being to our disadvantage that I think we're better off to nourish this sea change in Soviet policy and to take advantage of it in every way that we can in a non-zero-sum way. Yes?
Can you make an educated guess at the probability of a Tiananmen Square incident occurring?
Well, I think that it is much less likely in the Soviet Union because it is correct that the Chinese went after Perestroika and not Glasnost, and they were able, because they had retained much more centralized control, and the liberal movement was so new, to smash it. I think it would be much, much more difficult for the Soviet Union, and I think even a hardliner would have in bringing about a coup would have very definite limits on how far he could go. He might be able to restore the dictatorial nature of the Brezhnev era, but he certainly could not, I think, go to a Stalinist form any longer. That's about as much as I think one can forecast. Yes?
I think you mentioned earlier that the majority of the Soviet armed forces are non-Russian. Is that correct?
Yes.
Is there any possibility that if any one of these republics decide to gain their independence, that they would have the ability from the standpoint of facilities or manpower or equipment to arm themselves?
Well, they do have local militias, as we heard from Jack Wheeler yesterday, but these are not well-trained or well-equipped in comparison to the military forces themselves. In Afghanistan, the Soviets learned very early that the Muslim soldiers in the Soviet forces became rapidly sympathetic to the Mujahideen, and they therefore had to rotate them out and bring in troops of Russian nationality. They have, I think, seen as a result of that the need to segregate their forces, and they have units that are pure Russian, or nearly so, that they would use, in my judgment, to smash the national republics of the Soviet Union rather than to use forces that contained any nationalities from those republics. Yes?
Would you comment on the technological differences between our armed forces and theirs, and if technology will play a major role in the foreseeable future in terms of our strategic advantage?
The technological differences are many. In many cases, the Soviet Union settles for less technology for the reason that they don't have nearly as much respect for human life as we do. I spent, for example, on the order of $5 million per aircraft in the F-14 aircraft to make sure we had a highly survivable capsule to eject the two pilots. The Russians, in their equivalent, the Foxbat fighter, didn't pay any attention to the need for an escape capsule, a very, very ineffective one, because they just train an extra pilot. It's much cheaper, and build another aircraft. So that in cases like that, they don't worry about the technology. In the case of their attack submarines, where they perceived a major tactical difference, they've spent a lot of money to try to get those quiet propellers, and they have submarines today that can run deeper than ours and faster than ours. Titanium hulls as compared to our non-titanium hulls, and much greater speed, but they have taken very dangerous shortcuts on safety that have caused them to lose some of their subs. Again, lack of respect for human life. I think that by and large, what one can say is that our technology gains more for us than their labor-intensive approach does. And wherever we've had a confrontation, for example, Soviet-provided equipment to the Libyans, we've won out very handily. And I believe that our technological advantage is part of the reason why there's confidence on both sides that our Navy could whip their Navy today and that our Air Forces could whip theirs. Yes?
Some measure of confusion in the support for information exchange and procurement, and the probable and a repeat of the problem of the propeller nature. How far does this procurement information go, and where are the limits?
I don't think we could ever expect the Soviets to give us more than the kind of information that we make public, namely the size of a specific procurement, the company from which it's being procured, and the general nature of that equipment. We would never, for example, even in the most open communications, have given the Soviets what they got from Toshiba, the specifics of how that quiet propeller was developed and built. And we're just at the beginning of this process of improving communications, and although Akhramayev and his successor are for it, it hasn't yet gotten down to the levels where we're getting everything we need. We've got a long way to go, but the important thing is that the process has begun, and their senior leadership, as Gorbachev has changed it, seems to be highly dedicated to it. And you can just be very sure that General Colin Powell, with his very close relationship to both Presidents Reagan and Bush will be pushing it hard. Yes?
Are we seeing the beginning of the end of the Cold War, or has it already occurred, or when do you see it ending?
I would say that we're seeing the possibility of the beginning of the end of it. I think it's clear that we have seen a very great cooling of the tensions for the reasons that I described and by the specific actions that I described. Whether or not that's permanent and whether Gorbachev really means, hey, fellas, give me 15 years to turn this thing around, we need to find out. And it's for that reason that we should never let our Congress bring us down faster than the Soviets come down in arms control reductions. I believe that the reason that Gorbachev has made the changes that he's made is because he sees the need to do it from the standpoint of the Soviet Union's internal interests. And therefore, I think he has another decision to make if and when the economy is finally turned around as to whether or not he or a successor is going to resume their march toward hegemony. That, again, could be a decision they make. If we are intelligent and alert and keep our defenses up, and I don't mean at their present level, but intelligently related to the Soviet Union, I think we can keep it in Soviet self-interest to continue the kind of ending of the Cold War that at least seems to be taking place tactically at the present time. Yes?
Take that out to its limit, if you will, for us. If you take all the optimistic assumptions, let's say that Gorbachev stays in office and that he's successful in doing what he seems to be trying to do today, and that we're successful in our arms control negotiations and so forth, can you foresee a day, 10 years out, 15 years out, where we would live in a world where there were virtually no offensive long-range nuclear weapons, or is that just
I can see a world in which we achieve these 50% reductions that both sides have pledged to try to do in the START talks. It's a very complex and tricky business to make sure that we are able to verify, but I think that is likely to come over the next 4 years. With regard to going much beyond that, I don't see that coming in 20 to 25 years, because when you begin to go below the 50% numbers that we now have, you begin to make China an important nuclear power to reckon with. You begin to make nations which have yet not fully developed their nuclear capability, such as India, which is nuclear capable but hasn't built any missiles yet, and others begin to be powers to be reckoned with. I think that rather I would see that the nature of the world 20 years hence, if all of your assumptions come to pass, is one in which the Soviet Union and the United States are working together much more closely to maintain, by a combination of power and diplomacy, a situation in which the other nations of the world do not try to match us, and over time perhaps even to negotiate that kind of an outcome. 50 to 100 years in the future, you might get down to the numbers you're talking about. Yes?
Admiral, aren't we really overlooking to some degree the tremendous ramifications that can occur as a result of the unrest in the various ethnic regions in the Soviet Union today? If I understood you right, you suggested that they might have to use military force to quell that, but is that really going to be the answer? It seems to me that this thing is so widespread and there are so many people who feel strongly about it, will the military really be able to suppress the will of the people in the long run? I mean, isn't this really the greatest danger to what might occur in the Soviet Union over the next couple of years?
Yes, but my own scenario would be that Gorbachev or his successor will be successful, as they're working on right now today, in granting to his nationalities a loose confederation arrangement with regard to their internal affairs. I believe that these internal pressures can force him to make the intelligent decision that they've got to let each individual nation decide what the nature of its economic structure is going to be, set its own rules with regard to the way in which they deal with foreign business and so forth, let them have control of the political process within, so provided they keep themselves subordinate to the Kremlin with regard to foreign and defense policy. I believe that granting that would be such a dramatic step forward for the nationalities that it would keep them content for 5 or 10 years. There would, of course, be agitation for more. But I believe that the Soviets can avoid having to smash if they take that kind of a step forward. And if one nation seeks to go beyond it, I think the Soviets would, in that case, use force. Because I don't think Gorbachev can possibly take the internal political flak that he would take from his party and his military and his apparatus if he let a nation get away from him. So I believe that although the other scenarios are quite believable, I believe that the Soviets are going to be able to deal with that, and that some of those accommodations will improve the economic situation, because it won't take the Baltic states nearly as long as it will take greater Russia to come into the modern era. After all, people in their 50s in the Baltic states still remember what it was like to be an entrepreneur. In Russia, you've got to be in your 90s to remember. Yes?
Admiral, what you just said, I think, may be reinforced in probability by the changes that occurred yesterday in the ruling Politburo. I haven't had the details yet, but I understood from the BBC this morning that he had thrown out three of his adversaries.
I didn't catch who they were. Do you?
Did you get the name? No, but I think that this reinforces your optimism.
Right, I think that's right. Peter, do you have their names?
Yeah, the three hardest liners in the Politburo, including the guy that ran the Ukraine.
Good. He's gone.
Shcherbinsky. As of this morning.
Was Ligachev one of them? The Minister of Agriculture?
No. Shcherbinsky.
Shcherbinsky is, of course, the Ukrainian fellow. Yeah. And that's a good development, because he was a pure Brezhnevite. Yes?
If you were to take the scenario that there definitely will be less money spent on the military in the U.S. as a likelihood, certainly everybody, most people in Congress feel that happen. And if you were to plan where that should hit, I mean, would you have a smaller standing army? Would you have less new technology? Would you have fewer missiles and ships deployed? Where would it come? And then how would that affect businesses in the United States?
First, I would want to see those reductions come from their relationship to the arms control agreements. If we're successful in achieving the reduction to 10 to 15% below present NATO numbers on both sides in Europe, then it ought to come from army forces, because that's then improved our situation from today's situation. We save money and we have closer, we have equality instead of inferiority. There is a reduction we could make immediately, in my judgment, and save billions and increase our efficiency, and that is to reduce the civil servants in our Pentagon by 50% and to reduce the military in our Pentagon by 30%. We have layer after layer of bureaucracy. If we can reduce the question askers in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, we can greatly reduce the question answerers in the services, and that's pure gain, no loss whatsoever. Following those kinds of reductions, if we achieve these trade-offs that Akramayev and Bill Crow have been talking about, you can take some reductions of both sides in the Navy and in equivalent air forces. I believe that one would in that kind of an environment, see increasing sums spent on research and development, because as you get smaller and reduce capabilities, you need to be even more certain that you're covering all your bets with regard to new technology so you can move in a hurry if you have to build up again. So I think that research and development activity, if you're involved in that, probably has a good future. If you're involved in the production of things for the military services, I think you're going to take some hits. And even with regard to things that support readiness, such as ammunition and spare parts. Yes?
Can you comment on
Soviet oil reserves and possible implications on the economy and military strategies?
On their oil reserves. Yes, so far as I know, I'm not a recent expert, but at the time that I was paying close attention to this, the Soviet Union was believed to have immense reserves of oil, and that if you throw in their whole empire, they come pretty close to having something like what the Saudis have. The Soviets have been trying very hard to improve their hard currency situation by selling oil to Western Europe and elsewhere. The reduction in prices has hurt their hard currency situation. I believe that we'll see them pushing that very hard in the future because they badly need it in order to support their agriculture, which unless their peasants are going to be willing to buy this leasing program, is always going to remain an area where they're not feeding themselves. Is that responsive to your question? Yes.
In this morning's keynote address, Hofstra mentioned a lessening of military influence, which is different than spending. Would you agree with the fact that there's a general lessening of military influence throughout the world? And if you think that's true, is that the right course?
I think that it's clear that Gorbachev's changes on the Soviet side have increased the visibility and reduced the influence of the military there. I think they're quite beholden to him at the present time, and it would take a coup leader a great deal of artful maneuvering to get them to support him. With regard to NATO, Otto von Habsburg was clear that it's changing from a military to a political alliance, and I think that's right, and it's going to be difficult to keep NATO forces at a level sufficient to maintain the equality that we hope to negotiate, because they're increasingly of the view, thanks to Gorbachev's clever PR, that he's not a threat. The polls show that they thought Reagan was more of a threat than Gorbachev was. So I think that is a fact. I believe that on the U.S. side, Bill Crowe has done a terrific job of selling our civilian authority on the fact that, yes, civilian control must always be maintained, but don't keep the military out of the negotiations. Let them participate in the details of verification, the details of how to achieve these conventional force reductions, the details of how to make the kind of arrangements that will avoid confrontations and shoot downs. There you need the military expertise, and I believe that in Dick Cheney, with whom I've had a talk, that we have a man that understands the need to continue to rely on him. So, and then finally, if you look at General Colin Powell, who knows the last two presidents, the once and sitting president, extremely well, has their high confidence, and has participated in the highest national security decisions, I think you're going to see the military influence being properly important, but not pervasive.
Thank you very much.
Right.